I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey guys, Jesse and Dara here at the Chord Club to chat with an amazing artist who also happens to be just a really cool, relatable person, which makes her accomplishments all the more inspiring. You might know her as the lead singer in the band Crooked Still, or from her more recent solo work, or maybe, like me, you were sitting around your parents' house one night when they turned on Prairie Home Companion, and there she was as well. Her new album is called In the Magic Hour, and she'll treat us to a live performance of that title track at the end of this conversation. Please welcome to Soul Sisters, Aoife O'Donovan. So let's just roll into a chat.
Great. Cool. And just, I don't get any, like, you can just throw curveballs at me and I'm not going to have any.
You're like, tell me your deepest, darkest secret desires.
See, let's start with that.
I feel like since you just said that, yeah, there's something already percolating in your mind. No, like, no, I hope they don't ask me about that thing. This is such a good way to start. Let's all go around and say a secret.
No. Okay. I don't have any secrets anyway.
Let's say something for the secret. What do we want to manifest in our lives?
Okay, well, this is a non sequitur. Yes. Let's just go with that, okay?
Yeah.
But I just can't stop admiring your ring. It's beautiful.
Oh, thank
you. It's gorgeous.
Thanks so much.
And one of my questions was going to be about, do you have a person in your life? And it looks like
I do. Yeah, I don't usually discuss it publicly, only just because it's
and
not...
I feel like you don't usually ask.
Yeah. I don't usually ask, but I was curious about the touring life and the musician life. We haven't really gotten into that, and it's a really interesting thing.
I'll just go for it. I literally never talk about it because it's sort of
exclusive.
It's also, I just think it's not at all like a part of my music, you know what I mean? I mean, it's not like, it's not a part of my image, I think, and it's just not, I'm not the kind of performer who wants to sort of talk about my personal life too much. But I have a great man, and he's a musician also, and is extremely supportive as I am of him, and it works out pretty great.
Did you meet as fellow musicians?
We met through musician friends. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Is his name Garrison Keillor?
His name is not Garrison Keillor. I'm great friends with Garrison Keillor's wife as well. So just in case she's listening, I hope that's not actually
secret.
A rumor that's going around.
I was just trying to think of the most random person that I know you're affiliated with who you could be engaged to.
No, God, no. He's somebody who's exactly my own age and classical musician. So, yeah.
Nice.
His name is Eric.
Okay.
And the touring life then, you both understand that? It's an easier thing?
Yeah, it's so much better. I think, I can't imagine being with somebody who was home all the time, just because I think it would be really hard to sort of always be the one who is leaving. Do you know what I mean? I think that's sort of a strange thing. It's really nice to be with somebody who, you know, even if you're going to be home for a couple of hours and you're busy, it's like they understand that you're busy because you're a self-employed musician, and it's great. We make the most of our time together, and it's amazing and fabulous, and yeah, very happy.
That's a really good argument for the pro column of dating another musician.
I think I think everybody's different for sure. I think I would say as long as you're with somebody who's like, on a similar motivational track as you, I think it's like, it doesn't really matter what they're doing, but as long as they're as long as you're like equally motivated, do you know what I mean?
Totally.
To get whatever it is.
Or equally unmotivated.
Or
whatever it is.
Equally.
Equally something. Yeah,
but on the same level of like, this is what we want to do today, and this is how we're going to get it done. And if you're with somebody who's like, but I just want to sit around and do nothing.
Right.
And you're like, but I don't. You're
like, later, chump.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yep. Not to be harsh, but definitely.
But it's also interesting you said that's not what sort of inspires your music.
I mean, of course, like, you know, musically, everything in your personal life does inspire it in some way. What I meant by that is that it's not, I think there are some musicians whose image is very much like my husband this, or my, you know, my children this, or whatever. And that's not
heartache.
Or like, you know, this person just did this to me, and this is, and then I wrote these songs about it. It's like, that's never really been, I just think it's sort of more interesting if there's a little bit of mystery involved in it, you know?
I think that's a perfect intro to you as an artist.
Yeah.
I mean, I think, you know, getting
maybe
into
not
it.
To a podcast, because we are not going to leave any mysteries here.
No.
No mysteries. No mysteries in the podcast world.
Yeah. Well, but I have a question. Do you live in Brooklyn? Is that right?
I do, yeah.
That was very surprising to me.
Really? Yes. Where did you think I lived?
Upper East Side? Somewhere that was more like Americana-ish or Southern or...
Really?
No, in Ireland.
Yeah, that's funny. Yeah, I grew up in Boston, and my dad is from Ireland. And, okay. But I live in magical Brooklyn. It's so magical.
No,
it
is.
Come on.
No, it is. As an artist, yes. It totally makes sense.
It's more like it's... I've lived there for almost 7 years, I guess, and I really love it. A great living situation. Yeah. A great little setup.
Are you in like pretty brownstone?
Yeah,
Brooklyn?
Brick row house and mm-hmm. backyard, and it's and, nice. And you know, family upstairs, and uh-huh. they've got a little baby, so it's so fun to get to go play with the baby. It's
the Brooklyn dream.
Yeah, kind of. It's great. Like, live on the same block as a bar and a coffee shop and a specialty cheese and beer store and
yep.
place where you can get crepes. And I live next to Prospect Park. And
is that inspiring?
It is actually inspiring, and I love being outside. I'm really into running. That's like my main, I would say, hobby. And so Prospect Park is a great place to sort of just get out. And today was a little cold, I will say. I was like, why am I doing this? But it is, it's super inspiring to live, I guess, in a city, but feel like you live in a little kind of in a little village, I guess, you know?
Yeah.
It's great.
Dara, have you been to Prospect Park? Because many Manhattanites have not, and I get very upset about it. So...
No comment.
Wait, okay. do you live in Manhattan?
I live in Manhattan.
On the Upper East Side?
I've been by Prospect Park many times.
It's not your fault. It's the fault of the people in your life
really
who haven't taken you there.
But there's concerts.
I prefer it to Central Park.
So do I. Well, mostly because there's less hills. So I'm thinking of it from a purely runner point of view. The couple of races that I've done in Central Park, I've been like, this sucks. I'm never coming here again. Too hilly.
Yeah.
Talk about tour life and running. Do you try to do that while you're on the
road?
Yeah,
that's I would say like my secret. That's awesome. My secret power.
That's awesome.
There you go.
Yeah.
Now it's revealed.
It's revealed. Yeah. I think just the consistency of having something that you can do every day.
Something active. Nice.
So, well, even just anything. You can do the same thing every day and be like, I'm going to have 30 minutes to myself or an hour or 20 minutes if you don't have very much time mm-hmm. and not talk to anybody and just like go outside and do it. I recommend it so much for musicians because you really have especially when you're on tour with other people, you don't have very much time to yourself. And I think if you're like, I'm going for a run, then it's, it's easier to do that than to be like, I'm just going to sit by myself. Don't talk to me, you know?
Yeah. So I do transcendental meditation. So that's exactly what I have to do is just be like,
people don't get
I'm going to go sit somewhere for 20 minutes, try to be a little quiet. And if you need anything, I know you'll want to just peek your head in, but don't. Please. And it's really hard.
It's hard to
explain.
Maybe in the future, people will be more understanding.
Well, and that also speaks to how you go as a musician, you don't stay out late at night. You don't get so wild and crazy that the next morning you're dead before you have to get up and drive and go to the next location. You can get up early and take a run before everybody has to go.
Exactly.
Do the thing,
I mean,
you know,
I think that a lot of musicians do stay up really late.
Right.
I'm happy that I'm giving the impression of somebody who never stays out late and is always extremely well behaved. But
so that isn't entirely true.
Well, it's like mostly true, I guess. Okay. But there's, you know, you do let loose sometimes.
Okay, good. It's healthy.
Yeah, exactly. You have to.
Okay, so now let's take it back. Boston. Irish Boston.
Well, sort of.
Okay.
Sort of.
Dad's from Ireland.
My dad's from Ireland. So it's kind of a different scene than what you might think, like the Irish American Boston community.
Yeah. How are they different?
Well, they're very different. The Irish American community in Boston is sort of, several generations back, even like, you know, those people would be, the people who were, say, my age would have been second or even third generation Irish American and kind of grown up in this tight-knit Irish American community of people who would come over sort of around the time. Did you guys see the movie Brooklyn?
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So like sort of that kind of wave of immigrants and their their families. Okay. My dad came over to the States in 1980. So he's from Ireland. He married my mom, who's American, and we grew up in Newton, Massachusetts, where there was not at all a big Irish population. And sort of my Irish connection is more like to Ireland and not necessarily with the Irish American community in Boston, although I did grow up heavily immersed in that scene through Irish step dancing, which is great, super fun thing. And he did have a ton of Irish friends, but we grew up in Newton, which is sort of not as much what you would associate when you think of like the movies with the Wahlbergs or you know what I mean, like that kind of thing. It's a little different.
Yeah. What's your mom's background?
She grew up in Boston as well, in Newton, where I grew up, and her father was the child of immigrants from Greece.
Okay.
And my grandmother was many generations back, a true Massachusetts Yankee, descended from the Salem witches.
Wow. All right. So what religiously was happening in your household?
Religion. God, you guys are really going for it.
I need the full context here.
I love this. My dad is, Irish and pretty anti the Catholic Church, as most people of his generation are, or at least a lot of people of his generation who grew up sort of under that iron rule in Ireland in the 50s and 60s would be. And my mom, very spiritual, not super religious. We went to church as kids. We went to a Presbyterian church that was actually pretty conservative, we were not a conservative family at all, but we ended up at this church that had a great group of people at it. And then I think once my parents kind of realized how conservative it was, they stopped going there, and we were just sort of a spiritual, let's, make food for homeless people kind of religious family.
Got it. Humanist kind of.
Yeah, exactly.
And then musically, what was happening in your house as a kid?
Very musical family. I'm the oldest of four kids, and my parents both play music and have tons of music parties growing up. So lots of musicians coming through town and people staying at our house and jamming all night. Jamming all night. And great Christmas parties where my mom would play the piano and my dad would, lead 12 Days of Christmas. And lots of music. It's sort of silly, kind of like Von Trapp's.
Yeah.
But
did either of them do it professionally?
My dad has a radio show. He works for a public radio station in Boston, WGBH. Still does.
Wow.
And he has an Irish music radio show. He's a DJ.
Wow, cool. That's awesome.
I grew up on a steady diet of public radio. And my mother was just a mom of four kids and also plays the piano and organs and sort of church jobs, plays for funerals and weddings and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So you grew up playing guitar?
I didn't actually grow up playing guitar. I grew up playing piano and singing, and I didn't really start playing guitar. I guess I took some guitar lessons in high school, but I didn't really start playing guitar seriously until maybe 4 or 5 years ago. I played guitar, like very sort of basic guitar, finger picking with two fingers and just sort of like Joan Baez inspired guitar parts. But it wasn't until I sort of like went solo, quote unquote, that I was like, I got to practice the guitar. So that's when I started to play guitar a little more.
So your aspirations in music when you were growing up were as a singer?
As a singer, yeah. Okay. And that's when I went to college for, singing.
Okay.
When did you... Okay, hang on. I feel like we've skipped something. Which is you going to Ireland as a child.
Yeah, yeah.
Tell us about that.
So sometimes I feel like I sound like a total spoiled brat when I describe like these idyllic summers.
I summered in Ireland.
Yeah, it was more just like that was the...
Going to visit the grandparents.
Yeah, I was going to visit family, and it was just this incredible sacrifice, I guess. I'm not even quite sure how they made it work, but every summer it was a commitment that I think they made to us so that we would have these relationships with our cousins and my grandparents. And my dad is one of nine kids, and he's the only one who left.
Wow.
And or he's one of two who left. He had a sister who went to the Bahamas as well, and she would go back also in the summers with her kid. But we would all be together in the summer. They're still a very close-knit family. Like, no...
How many cousins do you have?
Well, there's 27 grandchildren.
Wow.
And it sounds ridiculous, but we really did every summer all get together.
Wow.
And they would rent these little cottages on the beach, and like every day for weeks, we would just all be together.
And did you always love that, or was it hard sometimes?
It. Never hard. Okay. Always loved it.
It was
like, yeah, of course there were sort of tiffs and,
But I mean, to have to like leave your friends in the summers.
No,
to go
I
there?
Loved going to Ireland in the summer. It was amazing. It was magic. And some summers we went for the entire summer, and some summers we just went for like 3 weeks. So we'd still have time in Boston and,
Yeah. Would there be music there too?
Oh yeah, every night. It was just, yeah, singing, and everybody sings. It's like we're a big singing family. So it has
traditional Irish.
Nope, just like more sort of like one of my first performing memories is they did karaoke in, I think it was like 1993. I don't remember actually what year it was, but I think I was like 12 or maybe 11. And at the hotel, the Inchidani Hotel, which was like this dilapidated hotel on the beach that they've since renovated and turned into a 5-star, the Lodge and Spa at Inchidani Island. But they had a karaoke person come in, and I sang Leader of the Pack karaoke. And my cousin Jack and Kevin, they sang, God, they sang Little Old Lady from Pasadena. Like, I will really, like, never forget that.
Wow.
And we kind of, like, took over the karaoke thing. And we were probably so annoying. Like, because it was adults who wanted to do karaoke and, like, all these obnoxious kids who loved singing.
Yeah, but you were also singing, like, doo-wop music. I mean, at least you weren't singing Ace of Base or something.
We were obsessed with doo-wop music. We were obsessed with this, we had, like, a CD that came out around the time called 60s Dance Party. Uh-huh. And our other favorite CD was this Nancy Griffith record that came out around then called Other Voices, Other Rooms, with, like, all these old covers that she recorded. I think that was amazing. So it must have been, like, 94. Whenever that record came out, it was, like, the summer that record came out that we did all the karaoke.
Wow. So you were about 10 years old, 11 or something?
I guess I was probably 12 or 11, yeah, because I was born in end of 82. So, yeah.
So was it around...
82, baby.
82, yeah.
All of us?
Yeah.
Hell yeah.
Right.
It's a good year.
Yeah.
You have the dog.
A fine vintage.
Yes.
It is. It actually really is a fine vintage.
Is it?
That was, like, the best year for Bordeaux, I think.
I've never heard this.
Yeah, I think it's Fordo. I don't know. Okay. I should ask somebody who knows.
Make that up.
Yeah.
So was it around that time that you remember having the spark, like, ooh, this music thing is really cool?
No, I wanted to be a musician since I was like 5. I mean, it was much earlier than that. Yeah.
Wow.
I remember I had a journal and I wrote, like, I want to be a singer or a doctor. And I was definitely not going to be a doctor. That was never in the cards.
So it's been since then. Okay,
yeah. You mentioned Joan Baez. Did you want to do that kind of folky thing? Or
I got into that a little later when I was in high school. I got really into sort of like that sort of era of folk music, like the sort of protest music and the 60s. And that was when I was in high school. And I was just, you know, wanted to change the world.
And you're the product of public radio.
Yeah, and I grew up in like,
I feel
Newton,
like that explains
Massachusetts.
So much about you knowing that now.
I think it's funny. I think when you're from Massachusetts or like Boston, and it's just such a liberal bubble that I didn't even really realize how much of a liberal bubble it was until like probably too late. Like I was like, what? The rest of the world is not like this? which is both great, because I had a great childhood and I loved where I grew up, but the world is a big place.
Yeah. And I bet you have a lot of fans in parts of the country that are very different from where you grew up.
They are. And I think that's been a really incredible part of traveling, and especially actually coming up in kind of the more bluegrass world and doing a lot of folk and gospel music and not being a very sort of you know, an evangelical Christian in any way, or even personally religious, although I do love that music and I love the sort of spiritual nature of it. Sort of finding ways to be able to connect with people without alienating them or alienating myself. You know, I think that that's kind of the cool thing about music, is that it's supposed to bring people together and it's supposed to make, you know, it's supposed to bridge the gap.
Exactly. Yeah. So you started playing more in high school. Did you have a band?
Nope. Started playing guitar more. I was in choir and then, you know, a little bit of guitar, but I was very bad at guitar. I was in seventh grade is when I sort of first wrote songs with my friend Sarah Heaton, who is now an opera singer. We had a band called Fairy Mist, F-A-E-R-I-E, of course. And we wrote 2 songs that we recorded on cassette tape and submitted to a band contest.
And how'd you do?
We never heard back. Okay. We never heard back. But the songs were, I think they were good.
They
still hold up. We did this one. We set an E.E. Cummings poem to music. We were also obsessed with E.E. Cummings. We were obsessed with the Indigo Girls, which is hilarious that you guys just had them on this podcast because, I mean, we were obsessed
really?
With the Indigo Girls. Yes. Like this is still to this day a person who's one of my best friends. And then seventh grade, sixth grade is when we became friends. Like how we became friends is we would just walk through the halls of our middle school singing the song Ghost by the Indigo Girls.
Amazing.
There's a letter on the desktop. Like we were obsessed.
We heard a lot of those kinds of stories at the Indigo Girls concert where we recorded them. A lot of friendships came together over that band.
Yeah, absolutely.
They're so badass.
They're killing
it.
Yeah. Okay. So, and
I
then
feel like
you guys,
I also want to be asking you guys questions. Cause I feel like about this is like, or just like about like, hey, so where are you from? But it's like a one-sided conversation. I feel bad.
No, I mean,
I'm glad we'll it feels focus that on way.
You. I was going to say you can, but no one cares.
So you and she tried to submit these tapes for the contest. That didn't work out.
It didn't work out, but I was not, I don't think I was too upset about it. I don't really remember. Maybe I was, but, we kind of did it a little bit half-assed. We didn't even go to the store and buy like a fresh cassette tape. We recorded over, I think like a Red Sox game that my grandfather had recorded. Yes. So that you could kind of like still hear the Boston sports announcer on the other, like through, it was very,
oh, the good old days.
It was lo-fi. The tape definitely still exists. I really should try to find it. I wonder if my parents still have it somewhere.
You, like, made a copy and then send it?
We made a copy and we sent it, but I think you guys didn't even send it.
Maybe the other one sent it.
Or like our parents, we were like 12. Right. We were gonna like, mom, go to the post office. Yeah, and she was like, "This sucks. I'm not doing that."
But you wrote original songs.
Yes, we wrote one original song called "Lover's Secrets," and then set this E. Cummings poem called "Maggie and Millie and Molly and May to music." And
can you sing any of it?
Not without reverb.
Okay.
Without a Red Sox game.
It needs the other part. It's a duet. It needs both parts, okay, and the piano. I'll try to find the tape and maybe you guys can fly it in. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, exactly. We'll leave it in.
Okay.
And then
Indigo Girls, that makes so much sense. The harmonies.
They were super, super influential on me as sort of like a young aspiring musician. I mean, very young, like 12. In middle school and in high school, and also another group that we, Sarah and I, were obsessed with at that time was called The Story, with Jennifer Kimball and Jonathan Brooke. A great sort of like 90s female duet band.
Really?
Yeah.
How have we missed them?
I don't know.
Okay. Where did you guys grow up? Just tell me that.
Ohio.
Connecticut.
Okay. Well, maybe they were hip in Boston only. I don't know.
I just probably wasn't hip.
I was definitely not hip. I was a big nerd. I was just, yeah.
Three nerds born in the 82. Here we go.
Oh my God.
Cheers.
So many commonalities.
Look at us now. We're so cool.
Exactly.
So then what?
Okay, this is my whole life story. Yes, then high school, then so getting into sort of folk music and Joan Baez and Bob Dylan, and always was really into Joni Mitchell, of course, throughout that whole time. And then decided to go to college to study contemporary improvisation.
So how did the decision come to go to New England Conservatory versus anywhere else, like Berkeley or?
It was really random. It was sort of teacher-based. My high school chorus teacher, who was a great mentor of mine, Rick Travers, he knew of this program at New England Conservatory with this great teacher, Rand Blake. And he just kind of encouraged me to audition. It was sort of based on ear training and based on sort of, you know, development of personal style. And I, by the end of my senior year, even halfway through my senior year, I kind of didn't have like a clear path of, I wanted to be a musician, but I was like, maybe I'll go to regular college and study history or do something, you know, do a liberal arts thing. And I'm so glad that I was encouraged by him to go down the sort of conservatory route, because I mean, I can't even imagine my life turning out any other way. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So
did your parents have a vote, or what was their vote?
They were just super, they were excited no matter what. They were, I mean, nice. It's like liberal Boston family. They're like, whatever you want to do. They're,
right.
Yeah. It's again, the bubble thing. Like, uh-huh. Nobody's parents.
No, I don't know if that's true though.
Maybe you're right. Maybe parents were strict and were put a lot of pressure on their kids. My parents are just not that kind of,
yeah,
they're not that kind of people.
Mm. Cool.
Had you been taking
voice lessons?
I had, yeah. I took voice lessons in high school, classical voice lessons, and studied with a woman named Frances Cadenoff, who's still amazing and comes to my shows in Boston.
Aww, that's nice.
And yeah, my whole sort of musical, all my teachers over the years are still, I still see, you know, my teachers in college are still sort of a part of my life, and we'll show up at shows. Even Rand Blake, the guy who was the head of the program at New England Conservatory, he came in his wheelchair to a concert that I did at a club in Boston a couple of years ago. And it was just, it was incredible that he made the effort to show up at that. It was really amazing.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices
down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Wow. Nice.
So to what extent had you developed your style by the end of high school?
Oh, I would say zero. I would say my style is now that I'm sort of, you know, in it, it's just still developing. I think it's never something that becomes developed and then you sort of leave it at that. But it was in college that I sort of kind of got the concept of a style, of having a style and not sort of just imitating somebody else's style. And really, that was I think my major takeaway from the program that I did at New England Conservatory was sort of the individuality in music and the ability to be fluid in music and sort of take in your influences and sort of turn them into your own creative fire, if that makes sense. I think as a
awesome.
Yeah, as a performer, I think you, especially when you're just sort of finding your voice, it's hard to. You know, you end up you want to imitate other people, and you're inspired by somebody, so you might try to emulate what they do with a sound or with lyrics or with harmonic structure. And I'm sure I still do that without even knowing it now. But it's you know, it's all about being comfortable with who you are and figuring out how to make your voice come through with whatever it is that you're working on.
Yeah,
but these ideas were present in your college experience.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, that was actually a huge part of the curriculum, was style and really studying people who had come up. I remember we did, you know, there's a class called Development of Personal Style, and there was a class called Development of Long-Term Melodic Memory and Short-Term Melodic Memory, and listening to these recordings.
Did you not have these classes at the new school?
You went to the new school?
Yeah.
For music?
For jazz, yeah, for singing.
Oh, for jazz, mm-hmm. For jazz voice?
Yeah.
Really? So who did I know who went there at that time?
You know, so Becca Stevens? I was there. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, I love Becca Stevens. Good. Yeah.
Is that a teacher?
No, she's a student. She's a little younger, though. Maybe like a year younger?
She's a few years younger.
Yeah.
I went there when I was older, so I was...
Okay.
Yeah, so I was there at the same time.
Yeah, well, it's a really cool program.
What? It sounds
unusual. And it was just... And also, my year, I think it sort of depends who's there from year to year, but my sort of crop of students that were there, when I was there, everybody was just so engaged and so down to just try anything. And so there was no sort of like no shame. It wasn't the thing where I feel like I see in music schools these days, or even like teaching at camps, or I just did a week residency teaching at Oberlin. And there's sort of like people are kind of scared to try stuff. Hmm. And maybe it was because in 2000 to 2004, when I was there, 2003, there was like nobody really had laptops. Nobody really, almost nobody had cell phones. And like people were just kind of down to just jam all night and like just play weird music. And if you wrote a weird thing, you could be like, will you try this with me? And people would be like, yeah, absolutely. I'll meet you in the practice room in 10 minutes. And it was just
like, that's changed.
Well, maybe it hasn't changed, but it's like, it's definitely changed for me. I feel like I don't have that sense, sort of same like spark anymore, being like, oh, I'll try anything. I'm like, I just want to have coffee and go to bed.
Well, it's very different now.
Yeah, I guess you're right. Yeah, you're right. I'm not in college. Unfortunately.
Unfortunately.
No, just joking. God help me. But it's, I don't know how, I'm just really glad I was sort of in college before. I think there were like less distractions then, actually, quite honestly, especially my freshman year, especially sort of like figuring out what kind of like course of study, who I wanted to play with. And there was no distraction. Like people weren't on their phones. People weren't on Facebook. People weren't doing really anything except for like playing music with each other. And that definitely has changed.
So you started in 2000?
Yeah.
So Napster hit during your freshman year, right?
I guess, but nobody was even like, people literally did not have laptops. I don't know if like the people who went to NEC were just like not into it, but like I did not have a laptop until 2003.
Did you have desktops?
Nope. There was one. Some people had desktops, yeah, wow. Like people, because you didn't like need it. You had Maybe yeah. Some people did.
I guess, were you writing, did you have to write papers ever?
Or? Yeah, but there was a computer lab, which was like where all the cool social activity happened.
Totally.
It was so yeah, fun. Yeah,
that's universal, I think.
Yeah, the computer lab was where we all hung out.
Yes,
and like I do miss the computer labs.
And there was, late nights,
exactly,
all-nighters.
Exactly, so yeah. much fun.
And then you go home and you're done.
Yeah, yeah exactly.
Really exactly. So much. Well, you could write with a pen yeah. and paper.
Yeah. No, I did not get a laptop until 03. And there's also a computer on each floor of the dorm in like the main area.
Was there a phone booth?
There was probably a phone booth in the first floor of the dorm. I know. Let's talk about something else.
It's so interesting. I think it's so interesting. You were like, did you have to write charts?
Oh, yeah. We did write. Yeah.
I wonder if they do still at the
they
new
must,
school.
Because
sure
you still
do.
Have to have the skill to be able to write a chart. If you're doing a session with somebody and you're like, oh, shit, I didn't bring the chart. Like, right. No.
But don't they feels... aren't there programs for that now? Like when you whip out a
yeah, but that just takes so much longer. I feel like it's so much easier to just make a chart by hand. But maybe that this like I really sound like an old fogey now.
No, I don't know. I wonder what the.
It's great. We're like old ladies at lunch right now.
We're not that old. Come on.
I'm very comfortable with it. I'm
yeah,
very happy.
Totally.
But
well, I didn't go to music school, but I took mandolin lessons a couple years ago
from who?
Some guy at the Hollywood Music Academy in LA.
Cool.
But I just bring it up because I was made to practice to Crooked Stills' Shady Grove.
You are joking.
And so there was like 2 weeks, which that I just put together yesterday, where I was practicing again and again and again to you.
That is like so practicing weird. A mandolin chop or something?
I was practicing the melody.
Like da 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 da,
yep.
da. That's so cute. That's amazing.
Yeah, so thanks for
no
helping
problem,
me.
No problem. That's a pretty old recording. It's from 04.
Yeah, it was early, right?
Very early. Yeah.
Yeah.
Early on.
So you're my musical education.
Oh, great. I love
very
that.
Cool.
Yeah. Okay. So what's your thinking career wise while you're in school? Are you concerned about that? How much are you thinking? Like how viable of a career am I gonna have when I get out?
No, because what 18-year-old thinks that way?
That's true. I know, but I think it's so interesting that music, since you're kind of in vocational school.
Yeah, you are. Right. You're definitely in vocational right. school. Yeah, and you're.
I know, but you guys don't act like it.
I know. I wasn't really thinking that way at the time. And also, I had sort of like odd jobs all through college too. I like babysat, and I had worked at a pizza place, and like I still did other stuff. Right. And
you're like, I'll just babysit.
Yeah, even when that was like, I actually had an amazing babysitting job that I still had until I was like 25 that I loved. And it's like my biggest advice I would say to like young musicians is don't be afraid to just get a regular job so that you can still be really stoked on music and not be totally broke trying to play crappy gigs. Because I think that's a lot of people,
an interesting debate. I mean, a regular job though, was your babysitting thing like
it was
a 9 to 5?
No, okay. But
flexible is the key to regular.
Okay, yes, but like don't. I think there's a lot of young people now who, especially musicians, who think that there's even people who are my own age who are musicians who are broke who sort of feel like if they get any kind of job that's not music that they've somehow failed, and I so strongly don't subscribe to that.
Is there a point at which you say that is the case in a way?
I don't think so. I feel like some of my favorite musicians, even people who are professional musicians who I kind of came up playing with, have had jobs the whole time. Like in Boston, especially in the bluegrass scene, all the great bluegrass players in Boston would show up on Tuesday nights at the Cantab, and they all worked at like MIT, or they were lighting designers, or they had jobs, and they were great musicians, and they played gigs, and they made extra cash on the side, and they loved music so much. And but they raised their families and they had jobs. And I feel like, of course, that's, I'm not saying everybody has to have a job, but I think that the shame sort of associated with like the musician having a day job, I really think is entitled and weird.
That's very interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Maybe I'm alone in that.
No,
do you disagree?
I think I don't disagree at all. It's just interesting in the context of the sort of level of success where I'm seeing you.
Right.
And I think the conception of what does it mean to be a success goes hand in hand with you don't need to pay the bills some other way other than music.
Right. But I think that's not true at all. That's sort of the thing. And I mean, of course, I haven't had a job outside of music in many years, but I feel very lucky for that. But it's not that. I think success is such a strange.
This is the thing. What is success?
It's such a strange word because it's like success breeds success, and if you try to emanate success, then you're more successful just by the nature of the fact that you're acting like you're successful. I think that's true.
Okay,
the board.
Let's say contentedness, happiness in your daily work.
Right.
So the key would be then to have a job other than music that is completely fulfilling, and that means that there needs to be a space in you that has that.
Right. But I think for some people, the job itself doesn't have to be fulfilling, but the fact that
yep.
they're making enough money to pay their rent and then music can be the thing, the place yep. where they're completely fulfilled. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but of course it's different for everyone, 100%. But
that's very interesting.
Yeah, well, in terms of how I saw, what was I thinking about my career and how it was going to go mm-hmm. when I was freshman, sophomore in college, I certainly didn't think, I had pretty clear goals for myself of what I wanted to achieve and how I wanted to sort of go about achieving them, but they weren't necessarily tied to financial success.
Mm-hmm.
They were more tied to sort of this is I want to write music and I want to record music and I want to have you know a band that people know about and I want to yeah. sort of you know be gain some notoriety and etc.
That's the sticking point.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I want to gain some notoriety. I want to have a band that people know about.
Right.
And the more that would be true, the more that you're then right. That's just part of the dream.
Exactly.
It's like, I want to be a musician. I want to play music all the time, but I also want people to know about it and for that to be.
Right. Of course. Well, and I think that you need that though, to a yeah. certain extent to make it happen, unless you're one of the very lucky people who's just sort of plucked from obscurity and everybody loves you.
Yeah. And yeah. it must be so interesting because you kind of then came up in the switchover from there not being the internet to there being the internet.
Yeah.
And how do you gain notoriety as a musician pre 2005, 2006.
It was, yeah.
You know, God. It's a very different game,
it's
I think.
Such a different game. I mean, and it was really word of mouth. I feel like when
right, you didn't have to promote yourself too hard back then because there weren't as many tools to.
No, and you had actually had a lot more time to like, play music.
Right.
Because you didn't have to spend like all of your time
on Instagram.
Yeah, worrying about the next post or like your freaking email list. I mean,
mm-hmm.
it was, it's like,
oh, ladies,
preach.
Lunch. It's yeah, so I,
yeah, those are cucumber yeah. sandwiches.
Yeah.
We're changing the name of this podcast immediately.
Yeah, I love it.
Yeah, it was like flyers and.
Yeah, and even just sort of. Yeah, exactly. Flyers. Was that really what it was?
Right?
I think it was. And like a street team to put up your posters.
Yeah. So is that what you were doing when
yeah,
you got out?
With Crooked Still. So when yeah. I so it was all Crooked Still until, you know, until 2011.
Right. So you 2012. Met. So you're in college.
In college. And I started playing with a band called The Wayfaring Strangers. That was sort of my first like professional engagement. Tracy Bonham was in that band. You guys should have her on
yes,
this podcast.
Yes.
What? She's such a badass.
Oh my God. Yes, good recommendation, because she's married to Jason Fine, who's a friend of a friend of mine.
Excellent.
So, yes.
And she just has had, like, such an interesting...
Is that Mother?
Yeah, such she's an cool. interesting Goodness. Career trajectory.
I've been in her house in Woodstock. Hmm. I don't think she would remember, but I will remind her of that.
Yeah.
So get her on this podcast.
Yeah, get her on the podcast.
How did that happen?
So, well, she was a former student of Mac Glazer, the guy, the chair of the string department at Berklee, started this band. It was like a 9-piece jazz bluegrass fusion band, and I sang in it, and Jennifer Kimball, who I mentioned before, who was in the group called The Story, so I was getting to sing with this, you know, hero of mine from 8 years previous. And
sorry, is there much interplay between Berklee and New England?
Not so much. There's probably a lot more now than there was then, but I met Matt through I don't even remember how I met him. I think at the recital of a classmate of mine who did have some connections with Berklee, a fiddle playing classmate of mine.
So that's where did you play bluegrass at the conservatory?
Not really. I kind of got into it toward the end of the year.
Okay.
And then learned a bunch of tunes to sing with the Wayfaring Strangers at the Philly Folk Fest, and that was like my first gig. And I did a bunch of gigs with those guys, like 2001, 2002, 2003.
And were you like, I love this music. Like, this is it.
Yeah, I loved it, and it was just so fun to like actually perform in front of crowds and work on harmony singing and all that stuff. And then Crooked Still started around that same time and kind of started like learning that repertoire and making up these arrangements for the band. And in 2004, we went to Folk Alliance, and that's sort of how we kind of like decided to be a band. We were kind of playing locally around Boston at the Cantab and Club Passim. And then
take us through a little bit more in detail. So you met one member.
Corey, the bass player, Corey okay. DeMario, went to NEC, and then Greg List went to MIT. He was getting a PhD. And the cellist, Rashad Eggleston, went to Berklee.
And were any of them part of Wayfaring?
Nope. Okay. They were just all regular kind of Cantab. The Cantab Lounge was like where the whole music scene in Boston, the whole like bluegrass scene was sort of based around. And we all just met, you know, kind of met hanging out there.
When did you fall into bluegrass?
Then, at the end of my freshman year of college, right after Oh Brother, We're Out There came out.
Okay.
Came out.
Oh, was that what did it?
It's kind of what, it's not necessarily what did it, but it's kind of what got me when I went to the Cantab, like right after that movie came out, I was like, oh, this is that thing. I actually remember Natalie Portman was there one of those very first times I went to the Cantab because she was at Harvard.
Oh, was that
when
she...
Yeah.
Yeah, she was.
And
that's funny.
Everybody's like, oh, Natalie Portman's here. This is really strange. She went to the Bluegrass Night at the Cantab. I really wonder if she remembers that. But yeah, then I got really into bluegrass and sort of, it was a natural thing, obviously, because like the whole folk mm-hmm. thing from the 60s, there was already a bluegrass revival then. Mm-hmm. And it was kind of having another revival in sort of like the bigger sphere in the early 2000s. And yeah, that kind of led me on the Crooked Still path.
Very cool.
So you all were friends, you all had, and you felt this musical camaraderie come together. And then was there some writing that happened? How did it?
No, we never really wrote for that band. It was all sort of traditional like bluegrass repertoire, like bluegrass and gospel and sort of like old timey repertoire and a couple of covers, but mostly traditional music that we would sort of rearrange.
How would you choose it? Where would you find it?
We would find it from a lot of like, our first record was pretty like a lot of standards that we just kind of rearranged in this weird way. And I think that's why people kind of latched onto it, was because the cello and the banjo, we sort of did it in a different way than people had been doing these standards. And as the band kind of progressed, we would dig really deep into sort of archival recordings and find old, super obscure old songs and kind of arrange them with this sort of sound that our band had come to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Am I wrong to think that there is a connection to Irish music?
Not at all. Sort of the way that that music kind of evolved in the United States was that in Appalachia, what became old-time music was sort of these fiddlers from Ireland and Scotland, like way back when, sitting on the porch playing these tunes. And then kind of over the generations, they would sort of turn into more droney, old-time fiddle music, old-time Appalachian mountain music. And then Bill Monroe invented bluegrass music, sort of a combination of that, the music of his Uncle Penn on the fiddle, sort of mixed with jazz and blues and kind of became bluegrass, and then that became a whole genre in and of itself with Bill Monroe and Jimmy Martin and sort of Flatten Scruggs and the people of that era and the Carter family sort of writing new songs that then became firmly a part of the bluegrass vocabulary.
Thank you for defining that for me, because I get confused sometimes. Like my dad, when I was growing up, was always playing this kind of music, but it was like Irish folk music / string band music / bluegrass, and I kind of understood how those things connected, but I could never describe it to any of my friends at all.
It's like started with the immigration from the old country to the mountains and then went a little further down the mountain.
Yeah. So was your family into you going into that direction of bluegrass?
Oh yeah, totally. Yeah. They were huge fans. My parents are just huge music fans in general, so they were into it. Still into it.
So then how did the evolution of the band happen? I mean, like, what was next? You guys clearly became...
Yeah, we became a band. We played in Boston locally. Then we went to Folk Alliance in 04 and got our first couple gigs. Got a gig at Falcon Ridge Folk Festival and Newport Folk Festival. And so we were like, oh, we should make a record. We should make an album. So that's because we had gotten these two big gigs, we made an album.
Okay.
And it's hilarious to think about how different the music industry was then, because we went and made an album, you know, with money that Greg had saved up. And we went to Falcon Ridge Folk Festival and we sold 1,100 albums at the festival.
Wow.
Like, that day.
And you were unknown at that point.
Yep, we just played at the festival and that day, I think it was like 1,132 albums.
God.
How many people are at that festival? Like, you sold an album to every person who...
No, it was huge. Back then it was like 20,000, 15,000 people or something, or maybe 10,000.
But in a day?
I think that's unheard of today. Like, that could never, in a day.
No, it could never happen again.
Well, yeah, well, especially, I mean, what's an album now? No one's going to buy that. Right. Yeah.
It's crazy. Now I'm wondering if it was like 800, but it was definitely like, it was an absurd number.
So, and you even had that many with you.
Yeah, no, because we had been told, because it was like that. That's what happens if you break out at a festival, you sell 1,000 records.
And you're like, okay, I guess.
We never bought that many. Yeah. Bought too many, man.
Wow. You made your own album?
Did you? Now I sell like 10 albums at a show and I'm like, yes.
Yeah. Right.
big night.
It's crazy. Did you go into the studio yourselves? Like, how did you?
Yeah, we went in with a friend of ours, this fiddle player friend of ours, Hanukkah Castle, and she produced it. She, you know, took all the notes and helped us, you know, get the right takes. And we did it in like 3 days.
Wow. Are you still in college at this point?
Just finished. So far. Yeah. So we just finished.
Okay. And were you like, Crooked Stills is going to take you all these places?
I guess. Yeah. Well, at this time I'd also sort of like, I decided I had thought about making a solo album a couple years previous, and Wayfaring Strangers had put out an album in 02, and I was sort of like thinking maybe I'll do a solo record and I'll be the next Alison Krauss or whatever, you know, but that I'm really glad that we kind of stuck with the Crooked Still thing and went down that path, because it just ended up being really fun and it was great. I'm so glad I came up in a band and not spent my 20s sort of like slogging it out doing the solo thing. Because when you're on tour with a band with your best friends, it's so fun. And we had the best years. It was just crazy, you know, definitely slogging it out and sleeping like five people in a hotel room and playing great gigs and very crappy gigs, sometimes back to back.
And not going for a run every morning.
No, God, this is like the era of like Papa John's and the whole Crooked Still. All through our touring life, we toward the end of it, we traveled with a minivan and a trailer. And in the trailer, we had like all of our camping gear. We would like camp all the time. We had a cooler full of Coors Light. We would just like, we were pretty hedonistic, I would say.
How many of you were in the van?
There were four up until 2007. And then in 2007, the original cellist left and he was replaced by a cellist named Tristan Claridge and a fiddle player named Brittany Haas. So then I had another girl in the band and it was so fun. And we had so much fun.
How was that when the cellist left? How was that process?
It was what it was, you know. It was definitely time for a change, and I think a lot of people. He was very huge personality, just to sort of put it mildly. I don't know if you guys have checked him out, Rashad Eggleston, the Wild Snee Goblin. He's sort of like a crazy, crazy performer from another planet, and some people. We definitely lost a few fans, probably because his personality was just so enormous and hilarious and bizarre. There was sort of like a, you know, always a fear factor of watching a show and thinking like, what's he gonna do? You know, sometimes he would like jump off the stage or strip down literally to like a pink thong and perform a song. Like, no joke, like really extreme, bizarre, erratic behavior. But he's a performance artist and he still is. And I'm really glad that he left when he did, because I think he was able to sort of figure out his own thing, and he's doing his own thing and reaching tons of people, and it's great for him. And we were able to kind of reclaim the sort of musical, I think the thing that we were trying to go for.
For yourself, did you ever ponder if maybe pursuing that particular genre was going to have a ceiling that was lower than maybe if you were going after it in a pop genre, for example?
I don't think I ever thought about it in that way, but I think it was probably obvious that the ceiling in that genre was going to be much lower than had I been going for.
Like, I mean, it doesn't have to be, but
well, it kind of does. I mean, I think unless you cross over, unless you're somebody like Alison Krauss, right, who actually does the crossover, or even Bela Fleck, who was able to sort of collaborate with Dave Matthews and in that, remember that those eras, those days.
Not to date ourselves again.
I know. How many Dave Matthews concerts did you go to? More than one. Yeah. But I think one of the great things about the bluegrass world and that community, it is such a supportive community, even kind of fast forward to when Fossils came out. And even now, it's like a lot of people, even though I think the music that I'm making now is pretty far from that genre, people are still supportive. And my friends in that community and those festivals and like that whole world is still just like a huge part of, you know, the fabric of my musical life.
Yeah. I mean, it seems like once you get to a certain level in that world, you get to start playing with everybody. Like, yeah, the collaborations just get insane.
Exactly. There's a huge, the collaborations are crazy. And it's also like your heroes are not that far removed, you know? So you get to, I remember being at a festival a couple of years ago, at Delfest, actually at Del McCurry's festival, and getting to sing with Del McCurry and Tim O'Brien and being like, see, this is as good as it gets, and this is the best thing ever.
Yeah, and you've worked with Chris Thelia a lot, right?
A bunch, yeah, and he's a good friend.
And he's like the master mandolinist.
He's the master of the world now. Yes.
Yeah, I saw a little bit of the
Respect
of
to Sam
how
Bush.
To grow but a band.
Oh, you did? Okay.
Yeah, which is a documentary on his developing Punch Brothers.
Mm-hmm.
He's a prodigy. Yeah,
he's a total prodigy.
Yeah,
he's crazy.
But
he's amazing.
It seems like the world. Like, it's a small world. I mean, the bluegrass community, I'm sure, you know, once you get to a certain point, you kind of know everybody.
Yeah, you pretty much know everybody. And that's the good thing about it. It's great. And everybody's so supportive of everybody else. I think it's one of the few scenes where there's just like, there's genuine excitement for what other people are doing. And it's great.
How did you end up on the Goat Rodeo Sessions?
That was a
huge album.
Yeah, that was pretty big. Through Chris and I have been good friends for many years, and They had wanted to do something with a vocalist, female vocalist, and he suggested me. And I remember we had drinks, and he's like, "I want you to do this project." And I was like,
"Had he assembled the other guys?"
Yeah, it had already been going. They had already been working on the music, okay. And then they kind of brought me in, sort of toward the middle of the process. And yeah, it was pretty crazy.
Yo-Yo Ma, Edgar Meyer, and
Stuart Duncan.
Yeah,
great fiddler. And that was so fun. What a crazy whirlwind of a.
And that was like Grammy time.
Yeah, yep. Grammy time for. I didn't actually get my own Grammy. I was just going to say I was on a Grammy winning album.
That's not bad.
Yeah, not bad.
So when did the decision to go solo happen?
It sort of happened. It was kind of a long time coming. I think Crooked Still we had put out five studio albums, I think. Yeah, five studio albums and a live album. And it was just sort of time to make a change, and we didn't break up, and we played a show this summer, we played some shows last year, and it's still so fun to play with those guys. But
are they continuing on as a band?
No. Okay. It was time for everybody to sort of, I think, focus on other things.
How did you feel that?
How did we come to that? I think it was just sort of, well, what you're saying, like the ceiling, we just sort of, I think that like some of the creative energy had sort of maybe run its course for then, you know what I mean? Not that it's run its course forever. It was just, I think it was just needed a change. Something needed to happen to sort of revitalize it. And mm-hmm. hopefully we'll do something else in the future, but definitely time for a change.
Who was the first one to vocalize it?
I think me. Okay. It was not really met with resistance. I mean, it was Greg, the banjo player, had a new band he was really excited about. Corey had wanted to be home a little more. Brittany had a lot of stuff going on, and Tristan runs music camps and does a lot of. It was never a full time thing. We were not on the road. We all still did other things, and I really wanted time to just really focus on doing a solo thing and not sort of try to squeeze it into the cracks between Crooked Still tours.
Mm-hmm. Well, you also had two other bands. Or is it two other bands? Is I'm With Her and Sometimes Why, are those different bands?
Yeah, so Sometimes Why was a band that played a lot in like 06, 07, 08, and 09, and kind of haven't really played very many shows since 2010 at the most, and probably played like two shows since 2010. And I'm With Her is a band that only existed this last year, so that's a brand new band.
Oh, so I'm With Her overlaps with your solo.
Yes, I'm With Her is a brand new band. Yeah, and Sometimes Why I was a band in like 06 to 2010.
Is one of them the same in it?
Or nope, okay. Just me. Yeah.
My father's waiting for I'm With Her to come to Columbus, Ohio, so I just have to put in a special request.
Okay, yeah.
Keep that in the back of your mind.
2017.
He was like, "We're still waiting. You can tell her."
Lincoln
like,
Theater.
Okay, Dad. Yeah,
Lincoln Theater.
Exactly.
Great. So then Sometimes Why does overlap with Crooked Stills.
Exactly, Crooked Still. Yeah, singular.
Crooked Still.
Sometimes Why was a band, a trio, another female singing trio, that kind of came out of the scene that I'm talking about, the like late night bluegrass festivals with all your friends scene. Was in my early 20s, and Ruth Unger, who was one of the other women in it, and Kristen Andreasen, they were in a band called The Mammals and Uncle Earl. We were all sort of in these raucous string bands playing these same festivals, and we wanted a band that we could, like, after, you know, at the end of the night when everybody's jammed their face off and there's, you know, there's no more beer, there's only whiskey, and the lights go down and you're sitting around the campfire and you're just singing quiet songs. That was
awesome.
The sort of, and we would
that
sit and we would just sing quiet, really intensely personal, romantic, quiet songs. And it was beautiful, beautiful band. And we made two records. One came out in 05, God, or 06. Maybe it was even 05. It was a long time ago. And then 2009 was the second record.
But that was really the first time that you got to experiment a bunch with harmony.
Yeah, with harmony as an adult in my career, for sure. I've always, you know, it was so great to get to be working on these weird harmonies with those two. And but it was a very specific aesthetic as well. And actually, we went on tour opening for Chris Thiele and How to Grow a Band in the fall of 06 and a bunch in 2007 as well. So it was really,
wow,
really, really fun band. We would pile into like a tiny car and with all our Wurlitzer and our ukuleles and banjos, and sort of before everybody was doing the ukulele thing.
And did that reach a level where you were able to, where that was...
That was always a very, very small side project. That was just like, we would do records and we would do like, you know, 2 weeks of touring a year. It was never, the goal of that band was never more than that. It was always a small, you know, like we had our time. It was very sacred and it was really fun, but it wasn't, you know, we never wanted to bring that to a bigger scale.
Right. So the video I saw from 2009 of you guys at Banjo Gyms. That was Sometimes Why.
Yeah, Sometimes Why. Yep, yep.
A song called Too Repressed.
A song called Too Repressed. Yep, my anthem.
Did you write?
Did you write it? I did.
Oh my God, it's so good. And because I had seen the term noir,
folk noir,
and I thought to myself, what is that?
Yeah.
And then I saw that song. And I said, I kind of understood.
Yep, folk noir. Exactly.
Wait, explain it.
It's an X-rated song.
Okay.
Yes.
It's an X-rated song, and I wrote that song after a festival in North Carolina. It's just a very silly, but I still love that song, and I think that recording, you should check out the album version of it. Okay. It's a good recording. It's it has some X-rated lyrics on it. It's sort of like a female empowerment sex anthem, I would say.
Oh my God.
And okay. It's just so charming. Awesome. I mean, I've been to Banjo Gyms. It's this tiny little dive.
It's not there, hasn't been there in years.
Oh, I didn't even realize.
Yeah, it closed like probably 5 years ago. Yeah. Prospect Park. Yeah, right?
But it's it was like a little, you know, you're in Crooked Cell, you're in this band and you're playing in this little intimate place.
Well, Sometimes Why was that was, we only wanted to play tiny intimate places because the vibe of that band was like very late night. Like it had to be dark. It had to be whiskey. It could not be like, nobody could be talking at a Sometimes Why show because it was extremely quiet music and very intimate. And we would sort of play musical chairs. There's 3 chairs and whoever was singing lead would sit in the front chair and sing into one. We'd all sing into one microphone. It was very special.
That's also just so lovely. I mean, I sing in a sort of pop rock band, and the idea of being done playing your show or going to a show and then playing music for fun.
Yeah.
Like, that's not a thing.
It's
just so lovely.
And
then
you said you guys just go home after.
Oh yeah. We're to bed.
You should try that.
Yeah.
It's so nice.
It is really nice. It's amazing. That's actually the thing I think that's the best part about playing music with your friends is that like you do still want to play afterwards, you know, you do still want to hang out and sing and jam. So
nice.
Yeah. It's lovely.
But how about that solo career?
Oh yeah. This is a real retrospective. Guys.
Yes.
Yeah.
Going all the way till today.
So, okay.
So Fossils.
So yeah, Fossils.
Like how did it feel getting in that studio by yourself?
It felt great.
Yeah.
So over the years I had been kind of like honing these couple of songs, playing some original songs, had some people in New York that I played with, some great friends who are still, oh my gosh, excuse me, please edit that out. bass player named Jake Silver, a drummer named Rob McMillan, and a guitar player named Ryan Scott. And we all went into the studio together, actually. So they kind of flew out with me to Portland, Oregon. I got to work with Tucker Martin, who is that had been sort of my dream to get to make a record with him. And we tracked 8 of the 10 songs that ended up on Fossils as a band. And then they left, and then Tucker kind of went to work on sort of producing the songs. And pedal steel player from Boston flew out, Charlie Rose, and my sister flew out and sang harmony. And
really?
Yeah.
Aww.
So nice.
Yeah. So it was really fun. I'm really proud of that record. I think it was a good, solid first effort.
Yeah. Yeah. And then what's new about the new album?
So the new album is after Fossils, you know, I toured a ton behind Fossils, a lot with the bands and a lot solo and did a lot of support stuff. And the new record, which came out January 22nd, is called In the Magic Hour, and it's a collection of 10 songs, 9 original, 1 traditional Irish folk song.
I was wondering.
Yeah. It's an old Irish folk song called Donal Og.
Is that your grandfather?
Yeah, yeah. So it's a lot of the songs are sort of written. It's sort of like a meditation on like solitude and life and death, and a lot of it is inspired by my grandfather who passed away, and my Irish grandfather. So he had like this beautiful life. He was 93 when he died, and he had like one of those real magical Irish lives. He was a butcher, like, you know, not super educated, but like the most kind and warm man, and just amazing, and 9 kids and 27 grandkids, and just like a very warm and generous person. He loved singing, and yeah, so a lot of the songs are sort of inspired, not necessarily by him, but by sort of like that legacy and sort of childhood and nostalgia and all that stuff.
What is that recording of him?
Recording of him singing a different song called The West's Awake from my cousin's wedding that my dad had sent to me.
Wow.
Yeah. So it's just sort of like, that was a real last minute thing to fly that in. I'm so glad we did.
Yeah. Had you already like decided on that song?
Yeah.
And then you just worked it in.
That was like, the song was done. Being mixed, and I was like, oh my gosh, let's try to fly this in. And it worked so perfectly. So
it's really special.
Yeah.
That album is beautiful.
Oh, thank you so much, Dara.
It's so lovely. And it's one of those that can work, you know, I like and sort of zone out, and it's just so pretty to listen to. It's soothing. It's like water. It's like, it's just like, you know, all enveloping. And then if you zone in and listen to the lyrics, it's beautiful poetry. And
thank you so much. Thank you.
And the title track makes me think of God Only Knows every single time.
That's
I start
so funny.
It.
Yeah, people. A lot of people have been saying that. They're like, it really reminds me of God Only Knows. Oh yeah, I guess just, the dun dun dun.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
It's just at the very beginning, but it's like so distinctive that every time I'm like, oh,
God Only Knows.
It's funny.
Right, there's. It's a bit modern. It, like it has a modern.
It
feel.
Does. Yeah, mm-hmm. It does. I think that the difference, like the main difference, even though I worked with Tucker both times. The main difference was just that a lot of these songs, like I feel like Tucker was more able to kind of contribute to in sort of a production way.
Uh-huh.
He was just so helpful in sort of figuring out what sounds were going to go on them and who was going to play on it and how to sort of really make it a record that also is cohesive from start to finish.
Yeah. So now you're hitting the road?
Hitting the road. I just got back on Sunday from Europe. I did the first round of touring.
How'd it go?
It was great. Yeah. It was really fun. Awesome. Yep, we were driving around. I put a new group out on the road with me, a guitar player and vocalist. This guy named Anthony DaCosta, who's amazing, and a drummer named Steve Nister, and so fun. Trio, no bass. It's like pretty weird and cool, and low-strung guitar and great singing from him. And, we were in Ireland and Scotland and England and Denmark. And then...
Did your family come out to see you in Ireland?
They did. My parents even flew over.
Really?
They were there in Ireland and in Scotland.
They must be so proud.
They just love to party, so they'll go anywhere. They go anywhere that there's a party. It's just their excuse. They're like, we want to come to your show.
Where are you going to be playing in the States?
So starting a U.S. tour next week on Wednesday in Kansas. And actually a conference, Folk Alliance in Kansas. And then... Or I guess it's Missouri, Kansas City. What's the correct thing? And then Colorado, Phoenix, and then all up the West Coast. And then the sort of Midwest, East Coast portion starts at the end of March. And playing, it ends in New York.
Yay. Cool.
Yeah.
Back to Brooklyn.
Well, Bowery Ballroom. Lower East Side.
But I'm saying you physically will go back to Brooklyn.
I can't wait. Yes, exactly.
All right. Awesome. Well, thank you for taking us through that.
Yeah. Thank you so much. You guys, I was like, whew.
This is amazing.
It was like catching up.
Yeah, the whole
with
life.
An old friend that we have now.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So you live in Brooklyn?
Yeah.
Where do you live?
Well, I'm in Bushwick now after many years in Park Slope.
Okay, cool. That's like a reverse move, I feel like.
It is. It's been an adjustment.
Yeah, what brought you to Bushwick?
I feel almost too old for my neighborhood.
You've got a striped blazer. I feel like you can rock it.
You know, I'm trying to dress the part.
It's great.
Yeah.
I love Bushwick. Have you been to that restaurant Pharaoh?
I have not, but
have you heard of it?
That's my hood, yeah.
It's so good.
Is it?
It's so good. Have you been to Bushwick?
I'll go there.
I have been to Bushwick. Yes, I go to Bushwick.
She rehearses
in
Bushwick.
Okay. Yeah. You're like, no, I swear, I go there. Which part of the city do you live in?
East Village.
Okay. Yeah. So that's close.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's very cool.
What song are you going to play for us today?
I don't know. What song should I play?
Ooh, taking requests?
Sure.
In the Magic Hour?
Can you?
Sure, no problem.
Awesome.
Woo.
All right, here we go.
I'm Aoife, and this is Magic Hour, live from the Chord Club. In the magic hour, when the moon is low, and the sky is the kind of blue that you think you know, but you don't know. The turf cut is dark, he runs around her. All the fairy children, they run around her. All the other children, they make no sound. On the coast, and the waves nip at your heels like a dog. Pull me closer. It's past the time of the dinner bell, but before the shine of Orion's belt, and the sky is still bluer than a bluebell.
sticks and stones. Bury me not in the old graveyard where all my friends are beneath the heather on the high hillside.
It's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.